morning and welcome to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher here along with my co-host Renee Bodley. Coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from the Democratic candidate for Utah's 1st Congressional District, Dr. Peter Clemens. He's running against incumbent Rob Bishop, a Republican. The 1st District representative has long been a Republican. We'll talk to Dr. Clemens about his chances to change that. We should also mention that we did invite Congressman Bishop to be on the show. He declined.
Then Park City voters will decide if they want to pay for a $25 million bond to preserve a prized piece of open space. That's Bonanza Flats at the top of Guardsman's Pass. The prime acreage was being eyed by developers, and conservation advocates feared the flats could end up in the hands of high-end builders and turned into an exclusive resort for the, quote, 1% of the 1%. Park City Council voted to put the issue on the ballot. If approved, the money would go to buy the land and keep it open in perpetuity. We'll hear from Assistant City Manager Matt Dias about those plans.
And then school board candidates Pat Terbaltiller and Mo Hickey will be joining us in studio to tell us why they're running and what sets them apart from their opponent. We'll be opening the phone lines as well so you can ask them questions. Utah Politics Now will be right back after these messages.
My name is Alyssa Ayton. On November 4th, our community will come together for 24 hours of giving at livepcgivepc.org. Nonprofits enrich the lifestyle our family enjoys. Beautiful trails, safe mountains, wonderful entertainment, and excellent schools. So on 11-4-16, I'll live PC Give PC by supporting the organizations that support our lives.
Park City Community Foundation is a Summit County nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Amy Hayes.
And I'm Diamond Dave.
And I'm DJ Mike. We're part of the KPCW Air Force. You know, volunteer DJs.
Have you ever thought of a career in broadcasting, serving your community, and volunteering as a KPCW DJ? If so, KPCW wants you.
We'll train you.
Show you the ropes.
And get you on the air just like that.
For more information, email Dave at kpcw.org or just call the station, 435-649-9004.
Hi, my name's Lisa. I work at Recycle Utah. Do you know that we host on-site field trips at the center for scouts to school groups to learn the life cycles of different materials? You can even crush aluminum cans while you're there.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Utah Politics Now. I'm Renee Bodley here with Leslie Thatcher. We're switching things up a little bit. Instead of having Dr. Peter Clemens on the phone right now, we are going to go to our school board candidates. Three Park City school board seats are up for election, Districts 1, 2, and 3. Phil Kaplan's running unopposed in District 1 after candidate Greg Greer dropped out of the race a few weeks ago. Andrew Kaplan and Peter Yogman are running for District 2. We spoke to them a couple weeks ago. And District 3, which covers neighborhoods such as Park Meadows South, Park West, Silver Springs, and Ranch Road South, is open. And contesting for that seat, we've got Mo Hickey. You've been on school board before, but a different district. And his challenger, Petra Butler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
So we flipped a coin. Oh, we didn't flip a coin, but Petra said that she wanted to start first. So we'll let you go with your 60-second opening statement. Petra Butler.
Thank you. Thank you for having us this morning. My name is Petra Butler, and I just recently retired after 26 years in federal law enforcement. The first 5 years of my career I spent with the Secret Service. The last 21 I've spent with the FBI. I've been a public servant my entire career. My first job out of college, ironically, was that of a social worker working in the projects in Roxbury, Massachusetts. I knew I wanted to go into federal law enforcement, so I went to graduate school at Northeastern University. My background is what sets me apart from all the other candidates. Most of our candidates, the ones currently running, have either that financial or that business background, but I come from law enforcement, and I'm not aware of ever having anybody sitting on the school board before that comes from a law enforcement background. I think my background is very critical at this point in time. I think it's probably more critical now than it ever has been before due to the issues that our district is currently facing. So when we say that experience matters, I think we need to look at the experience that each person brings to the school board and look at what matters with regard to that. Thank you.
And Mo Hickey.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. My name is Mo Hickey. I've been a full-time Park City resident for the past 12 years, a second homeowner for 28 years. I'm originally from New York. My background is from the business side and the financial side, so I check both of those boxes. I spent most of my career in international finance, working in emerging market countries as well as in the Asian region. Moved to Park City about 12 years ago with my family. Two children, one's a senior, one's a sophomore at the high school currently. Got involved in education when I first moved here with the Manamek Poland, which was a father's group, getting fathers involved in their children's education. Subsequently ran for the school board in 2008 and 2012 for Precinct 1. Stepped down from Precinct 1 in June of 2015 when I moved my family over to the Park Meadows area, which was outside of my district, and have put my name back in the hat because I truly believe in the school district. And I think it's one of the most important assets we have in this town, and I care deeply about it.
So I got to just go back to your opening statement here, Petra. I mean, the school board, it's the school district receives the largest sum of our property tax dollars. So you would think that we would want people like Mo on there that have a good sense of business. You say it's really important with the law enforcement. As a law enforcer, I mean, what does that have to do with how our schools are run?
Well, Leslie, I bring a different background and a different mindset. I think, first of all, my investigative skills are very key to discussing and looking at issues that are currently facing our school board. When we make decisions, they should be data-driven, and because I come with that investigative mindset, I think I have the ability to not only research things very, very well, but to look at data and to make those decisions. I've conducted thousands of interviews in my lifetime, and I have the ability, I think, to speak very openly and very frankly with people, and the ability to communicate, which I think is also very key right now with regard to our school board. But most of all, I bring a background in dealing with kids. For the last 15 years in my career, I worked basically what's called crimes against children. And so I've dealt with kids that come from all different walks of life that are involved with maybe have mental health issues, substance abuse issues that haven't gotten involved with the law. And I think that brings a unique perspective, especially with what's currently happening in our schools. I've taught, not taught, but I've been to schools. I've given numerous presentations with regard to internet safety and just safety in general with regard to our students and our schools.
Yeah, Mo, though, it's really is a numbers game, isn't it? And in terms of what the board does, it doesn't have much one-on-one with kids themselves.
It really doesn't, and I think you take the children into account in all the decisions you make. The main responsibilities, the board has three main responsibilities as per statute, which is budget, fiduciary, policy, and then the hiring and firing of a superintendent or a business administrator. And I agree with you. I think we do have a lot of issues facing the school district right now, but one of the biggest issues that we've always faced here is revenue and revenue allocation, both at the local level and at the state level, which I think are going to be really coming to the forefront again in the next year to 2 years.
Mo, you were on the board, then resigned when you moved out of your district. You were a supporter of the $62 million bond, which failed in last year's election. It sounds like we could see a bond election next year. In your opinion, what projects should it include?
I think that we should focus on an academic bond. And the reason I call it an academic bond is we currently have about $20 million in our capital surplus account. I would say that we should take a certain allocation out of that account, put it into a special line item for future extracurricular needs, whether that's going to be expansion of fields or partnering with partnering with Park City Municipal or Snyderville Rec. Then I would focus on what our needs are academically. So the expansion of the high school would be number one. Then identifying whether we have a fifth, sixth grade school or a pre-K to six and add an additional elementary school at that level. I think that would allow the bond to be focused solely on the academic needs of the community, and it would take the extracurricular and put it maybe where it belonged in the first place, which is in partnership with, as I said, Basin Rec in the city.
Petra, how did you vote on the bond last year?
I did not support the bond, and I think if we would have had better community engagement, the issues about it being an academic bond would have been resolved with regard to the first bond, and we wouldn't be going through this process again. So I think with regard to the current process that we have in place, we need to make sure at this point in time that we keep the community engaged. I'm looking at the time schedule that we have planned now because the first community input meeting is going to be sometime in December. And I think that's critical. There's going to be another one in January, two more in January. And I think this is where their community needs to come out. They need to look at the three proposals that are going to be put out to the public, and they're going to need to voice their opinion.
Yeah, but I guess really what's changed, Petra? I mean, Treasure Mountain still needs to come down. We still need to get the ninth graders into Treasure Mountain. That means that we still need a school to house at least a couple of grades. All we've done is delay something for probably a project that's going to look a lot like what we proposed in the first place.
And there's probably a lot of truth in what you say, Leslie, but I think we needed more community input. I think people felt that it was directed towards a extracurricular bond as opposed to focusing on academics.
And I got to just follow up with this with both of you. I mean, last year the Park City Board of Education voted to build a 5-6 school. There are candidates who are now talking about looking at another K through 6 elementary school. But we heard from Board Member Julie Eihausen last week that this means that the board has to rescind that vote so that this can be discussed again. I mean, is that what we do? That discussion is still open in your mind, Mo?
Well, I think there's a legal process that has to take place when the board votes on something, and I'd have to go back and look and see, was the actual vote to move forward with the bond was the 5-6 part of the bond vote, or was it a vote specifically towards a 5-6? If there was a vote specifically towards a 5-6, then a board member who voted in favor of that would have to bring it back to the table to change that vote. But I think that being the case, I would still look at it and say, I favor personally a pre-K-6 based on what I've looked at so far. But I'd like to look at both and compare them side by side and say, what's best for the students, having a 5-6 or having a pre-K-6?
Do you have a preference, Petra?
And so I just want to say I was at the school board meeting where this came up, and they voted on, not voted, but there was a decision that was passed that they were going to move forward with the 5-6 school. So, yes, I think it does have to go back and be rescinded. I think we need to look at options. I think we need to be presented with pros and cons for every potential situation, and we really need to make a decision about what's best for the students in the community. Whether that's going to be that 5-6 school. And I think that option is still on the table. So, Julie, if you're listening, I think that option is still on the table. I don't think that door is closed. I think everybody on the school board is willing to look at the potential for a 5-6 school or a K through 6 school, whichever is going to make the most sense in our community.
Just a reminder to our listeners, we are going to open up our phone lines so you can ask your own questions to Mo Hickey and Petra Butler, the candidates for the school board. We'll do that in about 5 minutes at about 10:25.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, our teachers. Teachers are being asked to do more and more, not only teach but counsel, not only grade papers but discipline, not only decorate bulletin boards but purchase school supplies. So if elected, Petra, what are you willing to do for our teachers?
You know, I think the biggest issue, and I've had the opportunity to talk with a lot of teachers while I've been running for this position, you know, teachers feel that they're not valued and they're not respected. I had one teacher make the comment to me that she thought this past school year was one of the most toxic school environments she's ever had to work in. I had another teacher tell me that she felt like she's treated like hired help by some of the parents that she's dealt with. And these comments make me feel very, very sad. And so I want teachers to feel that they're valued and they're respected and that their profession is one that is very, very important. These teachers are in the classroom every day with our students, and we need to do all we can to support our teachers. We need to make sure that they have the appropriate resources. But on the flip side, we need to make sure that they're held accountable for what it is that they're doing.
And Mo, what would you do for our teachers?
Well, I agree with what Petra said as far as the respect that the teachers should be entitled to. It's a profession, and they should be treated as professionals. And I think there's been a problem nationwide for the past couple of years where teachers haven't been held in the esteem that they were held in the past, and they need to be held in. We also have a challenge coming up in the next year, which has been a nationwide challenge, and I'm really concerned about it. Right now, Utah has an 800 teacher shortage this current year. Nationwide, there's about a 3 million teacher shortage, and the number's widening simply because people are not entering the field. So I think it's we have to look locally at what we can do to make sure that we're attracting and retaining the best and the brightest teachers that we can, and retaining is a big part of that. And then the second part is working with the state at a legislative level to see what we're going to do long-term to address the needs that we have in this community, which is attracting teachers to come to the state of Utah. We're in competition with Arizona and Nevada, which have been ranked as two of the worst states in terms of teacher shortages in the country right now. And we're going to be fighting for teachers to come to the Park City.
Well, and that's something that's happening. Do you support getting allowing people with a college degree to get a teaching certificate on the job?
Here's my problem with that. It's going to put in, you brought up a good question earlier. We're going to be placing yet another burden on an existing teacher with what they're currently trying to implement. So having someone come in who's never had teaching experience with no professional development and being assigned a mentor in the classroom all sounds great until you say, okay, that mentor already has a full workload, is teaching in the classroom, and now you're going to ask that person to take on someone who's never taught before. There are probably people that could walk into a classroom and be natural teachers. As I said earlier, my background was international finance for 20 years. I'm no more qualified to walk into a classroom and teach because of that background.
How do you feel about the...
So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Mo on this topic. I think there are certain classes that certainly we could have people come in that aren't necessarily credentialed with the ability to do that. Is it going to be for all classes? Absolutely not. But I think if we had to pick and choose, there are some classes, certainly some of those CTE classes, where we could have somebody that's got the correct professional background or the certain business background that could certainly come in and teach those classes.
We have a caller on the phone. We're going to get to that call right after these messages. You're listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Joe Simmons with the Park City High School. Stay in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday morning during Morning News with Leslie Thatcher, and in the afternoon with The Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things Park City Miners Athletics. The Minor Nation Report is brought to you in part by the Park City UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, U.S. Bank Park City, and Miller Orthodontics.
This Lost and Found Report is brought to you in part by Realtor Julie Hopkins at jhparkcity.com, 901-0616. Park City Title Company, providing escrow services in Summit and Wasatch Counties, 649-8322. And Intermountain Mortgage Company, local lending solutions since 1992, 649-6660.
It's 8:23. You're listening to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Renee Bodley. We're talking to the school board candidates running for District 3, Petra Butler and Mo Hickey. We have a caller on the line. Your question for the candidates.
Thank you for the time. And Petra and Mo, thank you for your volunteer for public service. My name is Chuck Klingenstein. In light of recent Utah shootings, school shootings, this week's Tuesday shooting outside of Union Middle School, in September 8th shooting outside the Kearns High School, what are the Park City School District policies and procedures for these types of events, and what is the school board's role in these instances and potential looming issue?
Well, Mo, since you've been on the board, you probably know the policies better than Petra.
Well, we have an annual security review that's done by the school board. It's presented. When I was on the school board, we had Kevin Orgel was working at the high school as our security officer. We also have a resource officer from the Park City Police Department in the Park City schools, and then we have a resource officer from the Sheriff's Department assigned from the county schools that are in the county. We have drills that are run at all the schools during the school year. We had an analysis done, I believe it was right before I left, so I want to say it was in the spring of 2014 was the last one that I was involved in, where we had brought in a retired FBI agent, a retired Homeland Security person who fortunately lived in town with the Sheriff's Department, with the Police Department. They did an analysis of all of our schools, made recommendations for changes that needed to be made, tweaks that needed to be made, most of which were followed up. I believe the one that was contentious at that time was putting barricades in front of the schools to block a vehicle from being able to ram through the front doors of one of our schools, which there was debate between the law enforcement people at that time on whether that was something that was practical and would have a beneficial effect.
And Petra, in light of what's happened this week, I mean, what are you, What are some of your thoughts about what the district needs to do?
You know, I agree with Mo, and I think collaboration between all the law enforcement entities that we have in the community is extremely important. But I do want to talk about some of the policies that the school district does have in place and some of the programs. Like, for instance, the school district has the I Love You Guys program currently in place. It is a standard response protocol that is used nationwide. And it deals not only with shootings, but it deals with any type of a safety-related issue that may be weather-related. If there's a fire at the school, if there's some sort of an accident that's taken place. And it uses terms and such as lockout, lockdown, evacuate, shelter. And these are being taught in all of our schools. Teachers are usually given some sort of a binder. Like, for instance, as a parent, would you know the difference if there was an email that came out that said something about a lockout or a lockdown? A lockout may be a situation such as if there was something outside on the school that might be a threat, they're going to bring everybody inside and lock those doors so that nobody can come in. That's going to be a lockout versus a lockdown. So say, for instance, there was a shooter that came onto the school campus. You wouldn't want to lock those doors because then first responders would not be able to get into the school. So that's going to be a lockdown type situation. These are drills that happen on a regular basis. I don't know the last time that we actually had one of these drills in our schools up here in Park City. But this is critical information that needs to get out to our parents, and that needs to come through communication. If we go back to the incident that happened of May 3rd of last year, and the anger that had erupted as a result of a lack of communication, when these types of situations happen, we need to know where that information is going to be. Do we want 400 parents showing up at the school to pick up their kids? Because the second part of the I Love You Guys program is about reunification, and we need to make sure that parents know where to go if there's an incident at any of our schools where they can get their children and where they're going to be safe. And so I think we need to look at what the district currently has in place.
Once again, we're taking calls. We've got about another 5 minutes. We'll be taking phone calls. That number, 435-655-8255. If you have any questions for Mo Hickey or Petra Butler. Petra, you got something you want to add?
I do. I just want to add one more thing. And today, for anybody who's interested, Wasatch County is doing a training that's being led by the Summit County Sheriff's Department in exactly the situation that we were just talking about with an active shooter situation. They're going to have more than 200 participants today. And I was invited to attend, so it's something I'm really looking forward to.
Mo, have you attended any drills like that in your 10 years as school board
member? I've attended the drills both as a parent and as a school district, a school board member. The last drill that I attended, just so we're required by law to do drills on an annual basis. The last one I had was a reunification drill at Treasure Mountain with my own daughter last, I believe it was April.
Let's move on to school start times. Mo, we'll start with you on this subject. Do you think that our high schoolers need to go to school later, and how do you adjust the earlier schools?
Well, I think all the research shows that it's better for teenagers to start later in terms of from a medical perspective. One of the things I go back to, which I found interesting, was the last time a survey was done of students when I was on the board, students and parents, 95% of the parents wanted the school start time to be later at the high school. 95% of the students wanted the regular class schedule at that time. A lot of that was because I think perceptions as far as jobs, perceptions as far as sport, extracurricular activities, et cetera. I think we can look at what I'd really like us to do is look at the start times, but also look at our overall schedule. I think board member Eyhausen recently made a recommendation that we could look at the high school possibly cutting class time short by a certain amount. I think we should look at things like that. But I also think that we have an opportunity right now with reorganizing the high school, bringing ninth graders back into it, looking at our start times. We've always wanted to look at our schedule and to see if does our schedule really meet the needs of our students. And one of the things that I think we should look at moving forward is the possibility of the high school being a year-round school, which would be 3 weeks on, off, 8 weeks on, 3 weeks off, 8 weeks on. We're no longer an agrarian economy, and things have changed. What that would allow would be a much more flexible schedule for students. There are students in this community that need to work. It's an unfortunate reality, and a lot of those jobs require them to go to work at 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I think we have to be cognizant of that. But I think we have an opportunity moving into the new setup at the high school, looking at the start times, to look at our schedule and look at some of the things that are successful across the country. So I would agree, yes, the high school should start, the late start should be offered, But one of the other things is last year we had 1,400 class periods missed with early release and late start parent release. So it's already taking place in the school. So I think, yes, we're looking at a potential policy fix, where I think I would really like us to look at the whole picture and say, what's best for all of our students and what's the most we can accomplish with making this change. I also don't think it's a good idea personally to have elementary school kids at a bus stop at 6:50, 6:55 in the morning in the black dark of winter in this town.
Thank you. Petra, we'll let you answer the question about school start times, then we have to move to our closing statements from each candidate. So Petra, tell us your thoughts on school start times.
So I have been involved with school start times over the last several months as part of my run for this position. I've gotten involved with almost everything I can in the community, and one of them was the start times committee. We talked about shaving minutes off of class time, and I can tell you the superintendent did not support this. In fact, it would require teacher renegotiations with regard to their contracts, and it was something that a pathway that they were not willing to go down. However, I think that is a very important option, and I'll be honest, Mo, I had never even thought or even heard of about the possibility of it becoming a year-round school, but I think what people need to understand is it's like sticking your finger in a pond of water and all the ripples that come out, because once you make a change, there are so many effects that happen as a result of making that change. And I think we need to carefully look at all of those changes and be able to address them all, including having to be at the bus stop at 6:45 in the morning if there's a potential school start time of 7:30.
We may forego very short closing statements. I want to take this call. Caller, you're on the line. Question for Mo or Petra, and there'll be very short answers.
Yes, the dual language immersion program. How does each candidate feel about it? And we love it, and we hope that they stay by it.
Thanks. Mo?
I'm on record as saying I support the program 100%. I voted for the expansion of the program when I was on the board, when we went from having the program at Parley's to having it at all four elementary schools. I would like us to continue the program. I'd like it to be expanded at the secondary level so that students have more opportunities to participate in languages and possibly add a third language in the AP realm when they get to the high school.
Petra, how do you feel about DLI?
You know, I also support DLI. I think what the school district is doing with regard to reviewing programs, which happened, DLI happened to be the first program, I think it's an outstanding way to make sure that our dollars are being spent in the right places. I wholeheartedly support DLI. I grew up in a dual language household. I do think we had some issues with regard to implementation that we are definitely working through, and I think it's something that we need to keep in mind as we move forward. I would like to see more opportunities for high school students, such as exchange programs, those types of things.
Okay, let's leave it at that. And a closing statement then. Petra, you're going to go first?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I just want to say thanks to everybody in this community. I know there are many voters out there that probably have already voted. It was a very humbling experience to run for this position. I think my background affords the school board to have a very unique individual sitting on their board making decisions about what's in the best interest of our students. I'd like to thank all the entities that have supported me throughout this process. I'd like to thank the numerous nonprofits that I've had the experience to get to know, including Park City Advocates, which support the Latino community. And I just want to say thank you to everybody. And one last thank you to all the teachers, the administrators, the superintendent, and everybody else for their support.
Okay, Mo Hickey.
I want to thank KPCW for hosting us and thank Petra for participating both in this forum and in the election. I truly believe we had accomplished a lot when I was on the school board my previous term. We implemented the pre-K program. We expanded all-day kindergarten. We expanded the dual language program. We added PC caps. We doubled the number of AP classes that we offered at the high school. And I really, truly believe that Park City School District is a special and unique place, especially in the state of Utah. I think we have some challenges coming in the next couple of years in terms of making sure that we provide the proper resources and revenue to make sure that those programs are stable and afforded to all of our students. So thank you.
Okay. Mo Hickey and Petra Butler, good luck. And again, thanks for your time. You're listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW.
My name is Mike Ruzick. On November 4th, our community will come together for 24 hours of giving at livepcgivepc.org. Our nonprofits make Park City the place we all love to work, play, and raise our families. They give 365 days a year. Live PC is one day per year that we can give back. So on 11/4/16, all Live PC and Give PC by supporting the organizations that support us.
Park City Community Foundation is a Summit County nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
It's 10:35 and you're listening to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Renee Bodley. Well, voters living within the city limits of Park City are being asked to bond for $25 million to purchase about 1,400 acres in the area known as Bonanza Flat. In the studio to tell us more, I have Assistant Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The property's in Wasatch County. It's not even on the market, and yet we're asking people to tax themselves once again. So if this is approved, bonds would be issued only for this parcel of property, correct?
That's correct. That's the existing council and mayor direction just for this property only, and it's a 10-year authorization, as you mentioned, for $25 million.
How do you know that $25 million is going to do it?
Great question. We don't know. We actually think that this is our best case scenario. We know we'll likely need some partnerships should this property become available. But given the city's financial position, our experience with open space purchases and bonds, we think this is a reasonable amount of money for us to kind of put our best foot forward should this property become available.
Is this property at risk? Did the city have some information about developers eyeing this property?
Well, I think that's always been kind of in the community's consciousness. I think that the community, our community, other communities around us have always been concerned about the development potential up there. But in particular, we were concerned when we saw the foreclosure action happen with Wells Fargo against Talisker. And you know, I think unanimously the mayor and city council wanted to ask the voters of this community, would they like to put themselves in the position, should the opportunity become available, to start having some real conversations about preserving this property long term.
So if this is approved, this would be, what, the fourth time that Park City voters have approved bonding for open space? I mean, we're already paying off $65 million worth of open space bonds?
You're correct. We have, this community has successfully had three previous open space bonds, one in 1998, 2002, and 2006. All three of those were successful and were sort of overwhelmingly supported by the community. And I guess I would just offer again, I think that the mayor and council thought this should be another decision point for the community and for voters to make.
Yeah. So of that $65 million, how much of it is paid off?
You know, I don't have that. I don't have that number in front of me. I apologize. I'd be happy to come back to you with that.
But I'm guessing at this point, open space, the line item for open space is going to be one, a big part of our tax bill. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, we do experience new growth every year. And property tax values have been increasing, which gives us the additional ability to leverage more dollars for preservation. But we're also, in some senses, we're running out of things to preserve. And this may be one of sort of the last iconic pieces of property. And we have a history of asking voters whether or not they support something like this. So, again, it's about 1,400 acres at the top of the hill. It's at the boundary of Summit County and Park City right along Guardsman Pass. And this has been something in the consciousness for a long time, and just reiterate a unanimous decision by the mayor and our council to say, you know, what do the voters feel about this? Is this something that they want to put themselves in the position to preserve should it become available? And your question, Renee, about is this enough? You know, we're not sure, but we think this is the best foot forward that we can put.
Have you heard from Wasatch County when you mentioned possible partnerships to enhance that $25 million price tag? What are you hearing from Wasatch County about possibly chipping in?
I don't think we've heard anything directly about a financial contribution. We have had some conversations with them, though, letting them know that we are interested in preservation of this property, that we are watching, you know, if there would be a development potential up there, what it would look like. And so I think that's probably a better question for them, to be honest. But, you know, our manager and our mayor and other individuals in our organization have had conversations with Mike Davis and other elected officials over there.
And what other partnerships could exist to help enhance the price?
Well, I'm going to just hypothetically, there are a number of local land preservation organizations in our community, obviously with Summit Lands and Utah Open Lands. And then there are other jurisdictions. I mean, you mentioned Wasatch County, and that may be one of several that could potentially rise up and say, do we want to move the needle here? Do they want to share in a shared effort, again, should this property become available, because it is not currently available today? So, you know, this obviously, the neat thing about this property is it sort of meets three or four different jurisdictional lines. You have Salt Lake County, Wasatch County, Summit County, Park City, you know, Midway. I could go on and on and on. And At some point, we hope that there's a conversation about what level these other entities have and an interest in preserving this.
So what do we know about the likelihood of this property even coming on the market? And if it does, I mean, has it now become a bidding war between Park City Municipal and the Discovery Land Company?
Well, we don't know. We know that the foreclosure activity was a result of Wells Fargo foreclosing on Talisker. So the property is now owned by Wells Fargo, and it's actually being it's owned outright by a subsidiary of Wells Fargo called Redis, which is a development subsidiary of Wells Fargo. We are aware, as many folks in the community are aware, and we've shared this publicly, that Discovery Land is interested and is talking to Wells Fargo, but that's the extent of it. We don't know much more. There is sort of rumors out in the community about has it closed, has it not closed. We're unable to confirm any of that. We're just able to confirm that they are in talks. And again, what this does is it sends a public message. You know, would it be improved or should it be approved? It would send a public message to any entity or any subsidiary or any interested party, were it to be approved, that Park City is interested in playing a role in the future preservation of this property, whether it's with Wells Fargo or a future owner of the property.
What do you know about Discovery Land? My understanding is they're the developers behind Yellowstone Club, which is incredibly high-end.
That's about the extent of what I know. We know that they're a very kind of well-off, strongly capitalized developer that's got some very, very eloquent and very elegant high-end properties around the country and around the world. Golf and leisure and hospitality services tend to be their focus. That's about the extent of what we know.
So what's the worst case scenario in City Hall's mind, that this Bonanza Flats becomes gated property, that access is cut off, no more backcountry skiing, no more hiking, that the land belongs to gazillionaires who are there 10 days out of the year?
Well, that's an alternative. I don't know if I could speak specifically to what would or wouldn't be allowed up there in terms of gates or not gates, but I think that's a better question for people in our community to sort of contemplate. Are they interested in learning more about what could be done up there? And they can do this if they attend our next public council meeting, which is on November 3rd. So a week from today, we have our final public hearing on the matter. We've had two public hearings. And this would be a wonderful opportunity for people to come to the council meeting and learn more about the bond, learn more about the property, learn more about the property owners, and provide perhaps their comment and their feedback to the city council in a public meeting and on the record.
What have you been hearing in those public hearings?
We have been hearing predominantly support. I mean, we've been hearing a little bit of questions about, you know, it seems a little strange that the property is not available, yet you're asking for this authorization. That's a conversation that a lot of people have to have to sort of understand that it's not currently available because of the owner and the proceedings, but we're trying to put ourselves in the position to potentially play a role should it become available. But overwhelmingly, it's been largely positive. I want to comment. I just want to thank you for having us. So we have a public hearing coming up on Thursday, and I want to make sure that I'm here to answer questions because I'm a city official.
What you haven't answered is how much this is going to cost.
Yeah, and we don't know long term, but our ask to the voters or the city council and mayor is authorization for $25 million.
And so at $25 million, though, so what is that going to cost a taxpayer?
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, Leslie. That's helpful. So it's approximately $15 per $100,000 value on a primary resident. So if we took an $800,000 house, Leslie, it'd be approximately $120 a year additional on your property tax bill. If you're a commercial property owner or you're a second homeowner, it would be double that amount.
Great. All right. Matt Dias is assistant city manager. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Utah Politics Now.
Hello, this is Blake Christian, tax partner in the Park City office of HCVT CPAs. As we approach the important 2016 election cycle and the year-end tax planning season, we are very pleased to underwrite KPCW's newest program, Utah Politics Now. Thank you for listening, and HCVT can be accessed at hcvt.com.
And welcome back to Utah Politics Now. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Renee Bodley. Joining us now on the phone right now is Dr. Peter Clemens. He's the Democratic candidate for Utah's 1st Congressional District, which includes Summit County. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Clemens.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So, Dr. Clemens, this is a seat that's been held by Republicans, it seems like forever. We've had Rob Bishop, who's a 7-term incumbent, and before him it was Jim Hansen, who held the seat since 1981. You're the latest in a long list of Democrats who thought that maybe they could get this seat. Why do you think your chances are good this go around?
Well, this is an unusual year, Leslie, and I think that Congressman Bishop has distinguished himself by making for a lot of controversy in the district, some public lands issues that are not playing well with everyone who loves the land, irrespective of whether they're Democrats or Republicans. So I think there are some forces at work this go around. I think there's also nationally a move to kind of throw the rascals out. You know, we've had gridlock for so long. I think the American people want to see Congress start doing their job again. And I think Congressman Bishop is rightly perceived as part of that problem.
Yeah, realistically, though, can a Democrat ever win in this district, or has gerrymandering prevented that?
Well, you know, nothing's immutable, right? I mean, change is going to happen. It's a question of what election cycle. And I think this election cycle lines up pretty well for our campaign for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, as I've said, Mr. Bishop's lack of popularity, we ran a poll in July. It was rated an A-plus poll by Nate Silver, 538. And this poll said that Mr. Bishop had 42% approval rating. That was the first question that was asked. It was a poll in which information was given about my stances and his voting record. And after that, that information was given, this was an 8-point race, according to public policy polling. And it was the best poll that was done in the district. The other polls were all very small polls. This was an 800 respondent poll. And so we know that this district has the potential to be a very close race. And I think we've prosecuted that effort. You know, about a week ago, 65% of the people who watched my debate with Congressman Bishop at Weber State University said that I won the debate. I received the endorsement of the Salt Lake Tribune last week. Just Monday night, I received the endorsement of the League of Conservation Voters. In fact, they reopened their endorsement process that they had closed so that they could endorse me in this race. So I think there are a lot of, you know, we have a lot of positive momentum, and we'll see what the voters have to say.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say, throw it out there. I mean, Mr. Bishop has the R behind his name, and that gives him just that much more support in this state. But if not this time, Dr. Clemens, I mean, what's your commitment to this? I mean, is this something you're willing to fight for again in a couple of years?
We might have a conversation about that a couple of weeks after November 8th, Leslie.
Okay.
So you may think the seat needs new blood, but there's also something to be said for experience. Bishop is the chairman of the House Resources Committee, which oversees open lands, public lands. That's pretty valuable when we have so much open and public land in this district. And he's also a senior member of the House Armed Services Committee. That's a big deal, especially if you have Hill Air Force Base in your district. So when you go up against experience like that, what sets you apart and makes you a more valuable representative to this district than the incumbent?
Well, you know, I would say that a lot of people say that his experience is bad experience. You know, I don't think we've ever had an extremist bill being proposed, such as the Public Lands Initiative. This bill has no possibility of passing. Were it to pass, it would be vetoed. It's an extremist package that rolls back wilderness protection. It declassifies wilderness. It essentially undoes the Wilderness Act. It allows for things to happen in wilderness that have not happened for a generation. It's a massive land grab for the parties that put Congressman Bishop in office. He gets 99% of his funding from outside the district, 92.6% from outside the state, and the vast preponderance of that comes from gas and oil companies. So, you know, connect the dots. We've taken millions of acres and opened them up to exploration and potential drilling. Congressman Bishop has made no qualms about the fact that he intends to take, quote unquote, take back the public lands from the federal government, an idea that's not popular with the voters. Over 50% of people when they understand what this means, are not in favor of it. And certainly anybody who wants access to the land should be against this bill, because it will eventually privatize land in Utah, just as it's happened in Texas and Idaho and other places where public lands have been lost, people's access has been lost. So I don't think that, you know, that experience necessarily is a good thing. And I think you can also say that a career politician, you know, Mr. Bishop was in the legislature for 16 years. Then he was a lobbyist for EnviroCare, tried to bring nuclear waste 10 times hotter than what the state of Utah was allowing during that hiatus of 3 years. And then he went into the Congress and tried to pass legislation, to influence legislation that would allow him to do just that, to bring nuclear waste into Utah. So, you know, I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, well, you know, you've got some experience, but it's not the experience that we want.
Dr. Clemens, I would love it if Congressman Bishop were here to answer what you've just said. And he declined our invitation, unfortunately. But in past interviews,
the debate experience he had the other night, I probably would have declined the invitation as well.
In past interviews, the congressman has said that PLI, his intent was to bring all of the stakeholders to the table. And he said a good compromise bill is one where nobody is happy. So what do you propose as a solution when you've got so many conflicting interests in these seven eastern counties in Utah? You have people whose livelihood depends on the extraction industry. You have conservationists and recreation people who want to save and conserve wilderness and protect that. These people want some certainty about what the use of this land is going to be. How do you give them that?
Well, you know, I'm all for compromise. Leslie, that was your question, right?
That was Renee.
Renee. Okay. Yeah, I'm all for compromise, and I think certainty, you know, when it's a well-crafted bill is a good thing. But, you know, first of all, this is not a compromise bill. As I've said, it redefines wilderness. It allows for millions of acres that are wilderness study areas, and other areas in which, extraction and exploration is not allowed currently. We actually have less wilderness after this bill rather than more, which is, you know, despite what Congressman Bishop says. Listen, I was with the Native Americans last night down in Salt Lake, and the Native tribes are aghast at the fact and very upset about the fact that the treaty obligations and laws which trump these obligations and laws come right underneath the Constitution in terms of their certainty, are being rolled back and ignored by Congressman Bishop's PLI. It will essentially grab 100,000 acres from the Ute Indian, Ouray, and Uinta reservation. Now, if you don't think that's a big deal, and if you think that, you know, we should start the era of land grab again, well, then I guess the PLI is a good bill for you. But if you're looking for something that respects the law, respects 100-year-old treaty law and obligations, then this is not a good bill. So I think, again, compromise is a good thing. I'm not suggesting that we don't need to be, stewards of the land, and that some of that includes being stewards over extraction, but that's not what this bill is. This is a quid pro quo to the gas and oil industry.
So you call Rob Bishop a career lawmaker. I'm guessing that means that you are in support of term limits. If so, how much? How many years?
You know, that's a great question. Let me tell you, I have already made a promise to the voters on multiple occasions as I've been campaigning that I will not serve more than 3 terms in Congress. I am self-imposing term limits on myself because I am so convinced that our founding fathers did not envision a paid political class. They envisioned farmers and artisans and, yes, maybe even doctors going to Congress and then going home. And so I will not serve for more than 3 years. I'm glad you asked me that question.
We've got about 5 minutes left, Dr. Clemens, and you are a doctor. You admit Obamacare needs fixing, and as a doctor, you can do it better than Congressman Bishop. What specifically do you think the problems are, and how would you improve them?
Sure, that's a great question. Thank you. Well, first of all, in the United States, we spend 20% of our GDP on healthcare. The next closest country in the developed world is Germany, and it spends about 15% of its GDP on healthcare. So we spend a lot of money, and unfortunately, our healthcare outcomes look a lot more like Bangladesh and Romania than they do like Germany, France, Switzerland, the countries that we'd like to be competing with. You know, if we were at the top of the pile, maybe we wouldn't have this conversation. But as long as we're spending 20% of our GDP on healthcare, we're going to have a hard time investing in infrastructure development that the American College of Civil Engineers says needs $1.44 trillion spent on it right now in our country to keep us from becoming a third world country. Investment on roads, bridges, highways, high-speed internet, high-speed rail, these sorts of things. So we need to find a way to reduce spending. So a few ways that we can do that immediately. When the Medicare Part D was passed in 2003 and Rob Bishop voted for that bill, that was a Bush-era entitlement package. There was no provision given to Medicare to negotiate costs with Big Pharma. So what we've seen is a steady, dramatic escalation in drug prices, particularly for our seniors, but really for everybody. I want to empower Medicare to be able to negotiate prices. That will save hundreds of millions and billions of dollars to the taxpayer. Secondly, Harvard School of Public Health had a great study that showed that there's tremendous waste in the private market, the private insurance market, hundreds of millions of dollars that can be saved. Thirdly, I believe that we need a public option. I think a public option will provide competition in the marketplace right now when companies like Aetna and Anthem and many other big companies, Altius, are fleeing the market. They've made it their intentions clear that they plan to get out of the healthcare exchange. So we need somebody who understands healthcare. I've been a physician for 25 plus years. I'm both a specialist and a primary care doctor. I understand the entire market, the delivery system. I've taught at a medical school. I was in the public health service. I provided when I was in the Army. I provided services to the troops. So I know the width and breadth of this market, and I believe that I have the ideas working across the aisle to help reduce healthcare costs and make healthcare affordable for everybody. And that's not where we are right now.
And just finally here, have you cast a ballot yet?
I have.
All right. Well, so then you can tell us who you voted for the presidential candidate.
Well, is that something you want to tell me, who you voted for?
As the Democratic representative.
Is sacred and I plan to keep it that way. I will tell you, I'm not actively campaigning for the Democratic nominee. I did cast my vote against Donald Trump, who I believe is remarkably unqualified to be president. The man who, by the way, Congressman Bishop has continued to endorse despite all of the things that he said about women, calling them pigs and dogs and the other sorts of things, openly advocating for sexual assault on women. I would never vote for that man for president. I'm actually not going to tell you who I voted for. I don't think I need to do that.
All right. I have 30 seconds to let our listeners know why they should cast their ballot for you, the Democrat.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm going to be listening to the voters in the first district. Congressman Bishop has, the last time we checked, had about 25 donors on his FEC report from inside the state of Utah. We have received all of our money from private individual donors, none of it from special interest. I will not be beholden to special interest. Congressman Bishop always will be. Also, as I told you, I plan to serve for only three terms, and so I think if it's attractive to the voters to get rid of the paid career politicians, they will vote for me.
All right, Dr. Peter Clemens, we appreciate your time this morning.
You've been listening.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks, Dr. Clemens. You've been listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW.
Utah Politics Now is sponsored by HCVT CPAs, located in Old Town, hcvt.com. Local programming on KPCW is brought to you by a generous grant from Summit County RapTax. Recreation, Arts, and Parks Cultural Grant supports organizations that enrich the overall quality of life for residents throughout the county.
Coming up next week on Utah Politics Now, if you haven't cast your ballot, we might have two people who can change your mind on how you want to vote. We'll have Boyd Matheson from the Conservative Sutherland Institute and Rachel Sanders from the Progressive Alliance for Better Utah.
You've been listening to Utah Politics Now here on KPCW Park City. It's 11 o'clock.